welcome back to Bibliosynensis.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. We are on
our third episode of season two.
Yes. Oh, thank you guys for joining us.
So what do we got today?
Today we are conquering the ever infamous writer's block.
Dun dun dun!
So, as you know, writer's block is kind of a taboo subject, right?
It's not a taboo subject. It's a terrible subject. What it is just the one thing that we all fear and for some reason victimize ourselves of being, you know, subjected to its power.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, but it's not really real. Surprise, people. It's not really real. Before we get into that, what are we drinking?
Okay, I am actually really, really excited to talk about this tea.
Yes.
This is dedicated to the podcast. This is Bibliophilia.
At last!
Yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers, everybody. For those of you that have been buying it, thank you so much. It seems to be turning into quite the popular tea this year, believe it or not.
Yeah. I know the ingredients are not all legal in every state of the U.S.
So we'll have to backtrack and explain that. But one of the ingredients in this is actually something I've been dying to put in a tea spectral blend for a while. And that's Damiana leaf.
Can you explain a little bit?
Yes. More? So backtracking. We have a Ren Fair here. I mean, unfortunately, due to COVID, it was canceled. But there's always this local tea company that comes in, and one of my favorite blends from them had a lot of Damiana leaf in it. And it was actually sold as an aphrodisiac, believe it or not.
Right.
Which is, again, why we put Bibliophilia instead of Bibliophile at the end of this as kind of a tongue-in-cheek to the title. But what I learned is while writing, it was like a complete go-to. I absolutely loved it, and I thought it was just the tea in itself, but then I was looking for that particular, I guess, that soft earthy note.
Right.
And then I realized it was the Damiana leaf, so went into my herbal supplier that I use to mix into the blends, and found some Damiana leaf, and I just couldn't find the right time to do it. So when Eugene and I were considering making a blend for the podcast, I instantly thought of Damiana leaf. And I just thought of the most comforting but steady blend I could possibly think of. And that's when I came up with just the classic blackberry sage notes.
Right.
But it's met with the vanilla bean, Damiana leaf, and marshmallow root.
Ah.
So it's a very, I want to say it's a very earthy version of blackberry sage. I mean, blackberry sage is already really naturally earthy, but that marshmallow root and Damiana together,
yeah,
kind of round it off to be a softer, earthy hit. It's not like earth and berry.
Yes.
It's just a very well-rounded, herbal, almost old-school feeling herbal tea.
Okay.
Damiana, the flavor profile of it, why don't you take a drink and tell me what you think of it, and I'll tell you what I think of it.
It's soft.
Yeah.
It's soft.
So it reminds me of rain.
Yeah, yeah, that dewiness.
Yeah, yeah. It feels like an early morning or a late misty dawn.
Right.
And I love listening to the rain while writing. I mean, the minute rain ever hits California,
yes.
You'll see me. That's like the first thing I want to do. I mean, I'm guilty of even canceling in on work or things right. like that. If any chance I can get to write in the rain, it's phenomenal.
So, Damiana, you've explained that it's actually an aphrodisiac. Yes. Is it for a romantic purpose, or does it do something?
Well, apparently it is an aphrodisiac. I guess it just stimulates you in that way. But for me, I've noticed any form of aphrodisiac, even patchouli, which is apparently an aphrodisiac, just makes me concentrate better. I guess it just makes you more alert.
Right.
So for me, I use mild amounts of aphrodisiac, or what people claim are aphrodisiacs. I mean, there's even horny goat weed out there, which I have yet to try, but any aphrodisiac I can get my hands on, I realize in small quantities, it's just really great for breaking writer's block, because you become a little more alert to everything.
That is interesting.
So I thought I would share that with all of you out there. So I guess I could safely say that this is the tea for writers on our collection.
That's so ironic. I always thought it was Daydreamer.
Well, see, Daydreamer has notes in it that were created for inspiration. It's just, again, kind of similar. It has aphrodisiac of passion fruit in it and roses.
Right.
But I find that, I guess I just find Daydreamer more of like a focuser at the same time. But in terms of like writing and just that like nesting, settling feeling.
Yeah.
I picture Bibliophilia more of that. I guess I would do more arts, like drawing or painting sort right. of thing with Daydreamer.
Right. So like what we actually mentioned on the last episode, when you're writing, you have to work.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing art, you have to relax.
Right.
So I guess there's the polar opposite, even though they're in the same spectrum here.
Yeah.
All right.
Wonderful. And also, we prepared Bibliophilia today just slightly under temperature. And we did it kind of like how you would prepare the degrees for a green tea. And we poured it in and we did like a 2 to 3 minute steep on this. But it brings out more of the earth notes, and we drink it black. But you can have it traditional roiling boil with milk and sugar. I feel like that brings out more of the vanilla bean note. But if you're looking for kind of your brew when it comes down to writing for the day, or however long you're planning, if you're planning the long hunker down, I would definitely recommend this tea.
Lovely.
Yeah.
So I guess that is an interesting segue into writer's block.
Right. So I figured we would organize this episode by, I asked you earlier this week, what are your three ways of getting out of writer's block?
Yes.
You were talking about writer's block being a myth, so we can talk about that, and I'll share my three facts and or opinions, and then right. we'll go into an article.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you want me to start now?
Yeah. Why is writer's block a myth?
Oh, that's okay.
Rolling your sleeves up.
Yeah. Writer's block is a myth because everyone believes that they could actually do novel writing, or basically journalism, without understanding their limit. People have a limit in mm-hmm. how much they can write. It's like you have a limit as to how much you could run. Mm-hmm. There's a limit over how much you could watch. And to disregard that you have a limit in writing is somewhat abusive.
I guess same thing with, like, we were talking about it last episode, being like a workout.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't expect to run a marathon all day, every day. Or once you finish the marathon, you don't expect to run another marathon.
Exactly. You gotta rest. I mean, I get it. You have to text your friend. I get it. You have to reply to emails. But if you really want to save up your energy for that novel, try to, like, you know, stay away from communication for a while.
Hmm.
You know, save some of the words that you're about to use on them and put it into your novel. I mean, I'm pretty sure that like, a lot of people have this problem of getting less of a vocabulary and a chance to articulate themselves on paper because you've spent your time slanging on, like, TikTok or Instagram or Facebook. And
right. So another, I guess, side job I do is I consult other tea rooms.
Yes.
And I also handle, on occasion, some of their social media. And I'm so used to the social media language for Tea Spectral that I have to catch myself specifically to write differently for these companies.
Yes.
And it's a completely different sound, but same thing with novel writing or writing in general. Like, I had to explain, like, I tutor and I teach, but one of the things I'm kind of known for is essay adjustments for college entrance or
right.
just, you know, like, college finals, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
And I have to tell people, writing an essay is not normal language.
No.
It's a show. It's a showmanship sort of thing.
Yeah.
And you need to treat it as such.
Yeah.
And you need to understand your audience and the purpose behind it and go at it.
I know in the publishing world, people put you at high repute just for writing essays. I mean, you may not be an essayist, but if you can show off that you can write an essay, all of a sudden people start realizing, like, oh, you might actually be collegiate academia.
Yeah, I mean, even I teach SAT, ACT, and the essay has been kind of an optional thing as of the past couple of years. But what people don't realize is when you're about to study, they give you that huge list of vocabulary words to know. And most of them you're never going to use again. Or if you're lucky and you get to a good college, you use them in your college writing. But that's about it.
Right.
So what ends up happening is you're supposed to kind of train for the whole year on those words. And the reason why is because you're writing for that specific reason to tell people that I'm worthy enough to go to this said college because I can speak your jargon.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know if I'm just giving away all the secrets at this point, but...
Oh, my goodness.
But that's always the first tip I tell people, and they tell me, like, look, I can only afford X amount of sessions with you. What do you recommend? How do I use these giant clunky books that you get at the bookstore? And I tell them, you know, if you're looking for something to do every day, work on the vocabulary, and then so on and so forth. But,
right.
It's a different form of language.
It is. It is. And it's surprising over how many languages you get to learn along the way. I mean, I know with law is mostly either Latin or French. And I get it. Both may sound like they're irrelevant to our, you know, to our standards of speaking. But in writing, it's a huge deal. It's a huge deal. And there's a huge art in the whole, I guess, industry of essayists. And it's something to look into. I highly encourage it.
Nice.
Like, beyond just academia.
So, okay.
Being that, you mentioned that you wanted me to say what I actually do.
Yeah. Again, from a poet.
Okay.
And then a novelist.
Right.
What is writer's block to a poet?
Right.
And how does that happen in your experience? And how do you get out of that?
Okay. Writer's block in a poet is literally you trying to convey your emotions like 24/7, and you get exhausted quickly just thinking about it. And a lot of the times, poets don't realize that their main goal is to have people walk in their shoes. So if you have an accent or you live in a certain city, they have to feel that. They gotta become that somehow. And those are your words. It's kind of like another way of saying, you know, I love you too, if that makes sense to anyone. And it's hard because you think, oh, I have writer's block. I can't convey my emotions. do realize that you're a human being. You feel multiple things at once. You can't just be sad all the time or in love all the time. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, it denies you of what spectrum you are.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the first few ways I've actually learned how to get around writer's block, quote unquote, is by trying to write in a different format.
Mm.
You know, if you like to write in free verse, try a traditional verse. If you like to write in prose, you know, attempt at writing a different type of prose. I guess, like, maybe try comedy, try drama, try something, you know? Especially if you can actually write scripts. I know some people have this weird idea that when you write scripts, you are belittling yourself as a writer and you're just giving into the money. But you don't know how much art there is into screenwriting, into playwriting, and it's so much fun.
Well, that was kind of our, what is it, gateway drug?
Yeah.
It's for writing. I mean, I don't think we ever never took writing seriously until
we produced a play. Yeah, yeah, that was interesting. But the second way I actually got around writer's block, exercise. I'm just going to say it.
Yeah.
It frees up a lot of air, it lets your blood flow, and you're able to think beyond yourself. And that's just the problem with a lot of people. And I'm not talking about just writers. I'm talking about anybody in any career. Mm-hmm. They think too highly of themselves. They take themselves too seriously. And when you exercise, you're able to relieve some of that stress, that tension, that burden, and just remove the chains from your back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take a break. It's just not relaxing, I guess, but take that break. But the last one I learned from Hollywood, and that's to steal.
Wow. Okay, interesting.
Steal as much as you can. I mean, Fred Astaire actually went up to Michael Jackson when he saw Michael Jackson dance, and he said, "You're an angry dancer." That's okay, so am I.
Hmm.
And if you've ever seen Smooth Criminal and The Bandwagon, or I don't know what you call that one show Fred Astaire did with the gangsters, they are using the exact same moves. Michael Jackson stole Fred Astaire's outfit, Fred Astaire's moves, Fred Astaire's, like, aesthetic, and he just made it more him.
Okay.
And we're there. Like, everybody does it.
Yeah. Very cool. Well, I can definitely say that you touched on quite a few of the points that I was going to bring up.
Oh.
But I can continue to talk more and more about writer's block. As a novelist, writer's block is almost like, I want to compare it to a bad toothache.
All right.
Or a migraine. It's just ruminating. It doesn't leave.
Yeah.
It's almost like an underlining anxiety that you get because you want to push through.
Yeah.
But you can't. And it's very frustrating, especially if you're like me, where I like to train and you're on a deadline to make sure that your book is complete.
Yeah.
It gets really frustrating. So I think the hardest point when you do get stuck is when you get to a crossroads in your story and you have to decide, like, oh, this would be a very fascinating plot point. Like, maybe, let's say, inspiration hits you.
Right.
And people think it's like the movies where it's just this inspiration hits you and this beautiful music plays in the background and you run off and you write this. But most of the time, when you spend so much time with your characters and your story, you're usually, I guess you could say, you're very in tune with it. When you hit another epiphany, And you have to decide if you want to add that to the story, and it would make it really good, but then it would side rail things, and you have to make adjustments for it.
Right.
Or you don't, and then you try to make a note of it and run the risk of putting it in the edit if you choose to eventually.
Right.
But then it won't be, it might not be nearly as good because it's not fresh. So I think that's the roughest side of writer's block for a novelist. For me, also ruminating on just the right mood or words to set like a pivotal point. I mean, I don't know if there's novel writers out there and they can agree with me on this, but sometimes you kind of tiptoe around the big one, so to speak, or the big scene, and you don't really want to write it because you want to leave that for all your energy one day. So you're kind of tiptoeing around, and there's just a point where you have to write it.
Okay.
And you get stuck because you almost say to yourself that it's not going to be good enough.
Right.
I remember listening to Neil Gaiman's lecture. We always bring this up. If there's any more artist or writer lectures out there that we can attend eventually live when COVID is not so
Yes.
much of an issue, I would love to go to more. I know I missed Anne Rice and a few others, but I kind of regret it. But I learned a lot from that, and one thing he said is he loved the idea of the graveyard book,
Yeah.
and he got the idea for graveyard book like pretty much right when he started writing.
Okay.
But he didn't think he was a good enough writer
Yeah, I remember
to
that
write
one.
it.
Yes.
And he eventually, what, 20 years down the line, decided he was good enough to write it, and that's when he did. And I've seen myself do that so many times. I look back at, like, Fate Pendulum, the story that I've been writing with Eugene since we were even friends. And I rewrite and rewrite. I think I'm on my fourth revision of Redemption, but I think this is like the first time I actually feel like I'm a skilled enough writer to tell the story.
Right.
And that's another thing for writer's block. So I guess I'll bring up some points.
Okay.
Hopefully they won't be the ones that you brought up. You did say work on another piece of writing or genre. For me, I try writing children's books.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, I love the challenge of trying to explain life to someone without saying it in such a curt, ugly way, I
Yes.
guess. And I think that's an interesting way to kind of get your brain to shift.
Yeah.
Along the lines of exercise, I think overall, as a novelist, leaving your little nest, I call it a nest because it's kind of what you do, you know, you build this like writing nook where you write, or even if you're out, you kind of create this little thing for
Right.
you,
This duck.
this nook. And yeah, I highly recommend just leaving that kind of atmosphere for a while. What really helps me is just going out and talking to people.
Yeah.
Try not to bring up your writing. Just simply say, I'm in it, I'm writing. Most of your friends will understand, but life imitates art and art imitates life. And there's a point where you'll have conversation with a friend or a family member or whoever you are
Right.
having a conversation with, and you'll realize maybe you're approaching the emotion of that character a certain different way, or maybe you're not seeing it in a light because you've been stuck in it for so long, but you're never going to get out of it unless you're just having a normal life conversation and you're out of that world.
Right.
So, that's definitely another tip.
I mean, from what I've actually seen from a lot of people is they're so insecure about whether they're good writers or not that they rather would actually tell the whole story to one person and get validation. And a lot of times when they get that validation, they just don't bother writing it sometimes.
And it's funny because I don't even get out of that writer's block issue unless I'm not talking about my book.
Right.
So it works for there's me almost conundrum. Every time.
Yeah, there's a conundrum right there.
But what's another thing I can recommend? Definitely setting a schedule for yourself. I know that I'm like the stickler in the group when it comes to that. I noticed that with talking to you and Luke. But when your body starts to know that this is your kind of nesting time, I'm going to just keep using that word.
Yeah.
When it's nesting time and it's time to bunker down and write, your brain switches on.
Right.
It's kind of like when your body knows it's time to work out. Why do they say you're either a morning workout person or an evening workout person? It's because your body knows and it expects it and it wants it. It's kind of like eating 3 meals a day or intermittent fasting. Your body adjusts to it. So I think that mental adjustment really helps.
Yeah.
And it helps your mind open up.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if there's anything we haven't brought up, hopefully this next article will.
Okay.
Any other thoughts you want to add before we move forward?
Yeah. I feel like I would love to elaborate on stealing.
Oh, go for it.
But it's a bit weird to actually say because, you know, oh my gosh, it's a sin.
Or would you like to bring that up maybe in a future episode?
Perhaps. I mean, I don't want to actually create an entire episode all about it.
Okay, so give us the rundown on this stealing.
I mean, people have said it before. There's only like 4 original ideas out there, and everything has been stolen. Even Shakespeare himself actually retold the whole story of, you know, Greek mythology and such, all through his plays. Mm-hmm. And the only reason why, you know, stealing is encouraged in the entertainment industry is we just want to know what sticks. Because one generation can actually be a highly empathetic generation, while the next generation can actually be very aggressive. And it depends on where you are as well. So if you're trying to entertain, which is a huge gauge in, you know, TV, movie, you know, even stand-up comedy, you need to actually understand that you are not just writing a story. You are trying to sympathize with your audience. Mm. And it's suddenly a communication back and forth. And I don't think people like to talk about the aftermath of stealing work because people are like worried, oh my goodness, plagiarizing is terrible. And I'm just like, have you not, you know, changed the names around? Have you not tried to use your own words rather than using old English? Because I'm going to let you know, we have, you know, a plethora of Mr. Darcy's out there. Okay? Yeah. We have a plethora of Romeo and Juliet out there.
Well, how about this? We wouldn't have the stereotype of Mary Sue.
Right.
If there wasn't any plagiarism.
Exactly. Exactly. And there's just, I get it, it's very self-serving. At least that's what the idea must sound like to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an art to it. And when you've run out of ideas, do you understand? You were inspired by many different artists, many different writers, and you are out there to actually express yourself. Try to say that you are not stealing and like you have never stolen before.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a lie, you know?
Hmm.
You are a very original artist. I will say that. You as a writer are an original artist. But an artist needs an audience. And if you cannot communicate with people, then why are you writing?
That's a good point.
So, that's it.
Okay. Wise words from Eugene, oh, everyone.
Ooh, boo.
So, the article I picked, there were a lot of interesting articles. I almost went with one from even the New Yorker, but This one I thought would be the most practical for us, for our listeners, and for us. It's by the Readsea blog, which is a company that connects authors with professionals and gives them that crossing over ability to publish.
Okay.
And this article is titled, How to Overcome Writer's Block, 20 Helpful Tips. So I thought I won't go into reading the whole thing because I highly encourage any of you that listen to follow the links and support these writers and to read. And I mean, if you feel compelled, do leave them a comment. Just like any other writers and readers, it's nothing without a community. So please do so. But I will go over their 20 points really quickly.
Very good.
And then we can go from there. How to overcome writer's block, 20 tips. Develop a routine. I said to do that.
Yeah.
I definitely agree. Do you agree? I actually never asked you. Do you think it's a good idea?
It's a good idea to have a routine. I mean, I'm not going to say that everybody can actually be very strict on themselves and is disciplined enough to actually follow that schedule.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us need to pay attention to a multitude of things happening around us, and obviously the immediate always takes over the important.
Right. I think my advice would be either give yourself a certain quota to write a day, or even just like tell yourself you're sitting down for the next 15 minutes to write.
Right.
And I think your body and your mind just kind of starts to look forward to it after a while. Like, usually I start to notice it by the third day. Others, maybe, they say it takes 2 weeks to change a habit.
Yes.
Or to make a habit. So I would definitely recommend that.
Lovely.
Okay, the second one is use imperfect words.
Imperfect words.
Mm-hmm.
How do you mean?
Just go with it. Stop trying to find the perfect way to say things and just plow it through it.
Okay, okay.
I can definitely benefit from that. Like I said, I usually tiptoe around epic scenes.
Yes, right? Yeah. I highly do recommend that for anybody that's writing, you know, prose.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that it's articulating more than just emotion. You're articulating a situation. And a lot of the times, like, it's hard to actually explain how slow or how quick a person actually feels or thinks in that situation and why they even hesitate.
Mm-hmm.
And I find hesitation in most novels as, well, novel.
Okay. Number three, which I brought up, do non-writing activities.
Yes.
For me, it's conversations with friends and family. They recommend things like cinema, go to a play, a gig, eat delicious food, stuff you want to do.
Definitely plays. Nothing like hits me harder than actually watching Macbeth live.
Yeah?
Oh, goodness. Thank God we're not on a stage. Macbeth, Macbeth, Macbeth. I can say it.
What's one of my favorite plays to watch live? Oh, Cyrano de Bergerac.
Oh, always makes you cry at the end.
I love Cyrano de Bergerac. I love all the different styles of it.
Ugh.
And since it is this time of year, and I was just talking about this with one of my students, The Crucible.
Ah, yes.
I love
yes.
all the different ways that people portray that story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love how a lot of the Shakespeare plays that were happening in the last decade
mm-hmm.
were actually taking very modern
yeah.
portrayals.
I think
of
we
it.
Watched The Tempest, was it?
Yes.
They made it look like a military.
Yeah, it looked like an Iraqi war.
It kind of looked like a bite off of House of Cards. It was really fascinating.
It was.
Yeah.
So,
let's see. Free write through it.
Free write. Oh my gosh. This is like for all the Mary Sue's.
I hate free writing.
It's like fanfiction.net half the time.
I feel like free writing is just, it's the warm up and I don't know. Maybe that's me.
Or maybe it's more like Wattpad because, you know, Wattpad has no regard.
Well, I use free writing to bulk. It sounds like I'm working out. I use 750 words, yeah. and I will free write just to keep my brain sharp and to be able to write 750 words. So when the time comes for me to write a novel, my brain is just like, all right, we've got the heavy lifting for this.
Yeah. Well, actually, I have to admit, I've done that myself, but with sonnets.
Hmm.
I mean, I started off with patriarchal and Shakespearean sonnets. You know, I'm writing in format, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
And the hardest ones, I feel, are like Pushkin sonnets. Like, that has, like, the most restrictive style out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it demands you to write in both, you know, masculine and feminine rhyme. It demands you to actually switch off your rhymes, you know, depending on which stanza you're on. And it, you know, it's Russian-style poetry, so obviously it needs to be gut-wrenching somehow.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to actually write stanza after stanza, and that is, like, mostly the reason why a sonneteer is a sonneteer,
mm-hmm.
is that they could actually write a story off of these stanzas, and that in itself takes a lot of discipline. And I get it, free writing is all about non-restriction, you know, like, say as you will, whatever you want. And I feel almost like that's why I kind of started to enjoy the American sentence,
mm-hmm.
which is basically the haiku, you know, 5-7-5 syllable poetry, syllabic poetry, sorry. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Ginsberg went ahead and actually said, let's just use all of the syllables in one sentence. You'll be fine. And you write it in a sonnet form, it actually makes you feel good. Because it's almost free verse. Almost.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
But either way, carry on.
Next thing, number 5, is relax on your first draft.
That's weird. What?
How does that work for a poet? I'm curious, because you're always being so strict in terms of the rhyme. How do you edit poetry? I guess that's another good question. What does a poetic first draft look like?
Poetic first draft looks kind of like poetic second draft, because I don't know, unless you're actually, you know, writing in American colloquialism, I don't see how you could actually edit that, because a majority of our structured poems are due to the fact that the English were obsessed with Italian stanzas, and Italians were just writing lyrics.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's not until you actually make it to, like, American-style writing that you actually introduce the reader to punctuations and, you know, awkwardly, I guess, set up sentences.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Bukowski, oof. You want to go right ahead and talk about someone that gives you a headache, you know? Read Bukowski. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people love him. You know, growing up in North Hollywood, everybody loved Bukowski, and I got so sick of him. But sadly, I relate to him so much right now. The guy took, like, how many jobs? And just jumped everywhere. And he practically lived the recession, you know? So
I could see that.
Yeah. I mean, punctuations in an American style poetry is very necessary.
Well, for a novelist, I want to say that a first draft to me looks like a poorly timed film.
Say that again?
Have you ever watched, like, maybe a B movie or an indie film that was just so bad and it just never seemed to hit?
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of what a first draft looks like from a novel. Is you finish this whole thing.
Yeah.
And now you know where everything sits, but maybe the characters are just off and not hitting those time plates.
Like, they're not hitting the notes.
Yeah, they're not. So it just looks really out of key.
Yeah. It just creates an awkward ambiance.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, to me, that's how novelist's first draft looks like.
Okay.
And I have to say, I actually used to hate editing, but now it's like, it is one of the most Like, it's the thing I look forward to.
It's crucial.
Yeah, I actually enjoy editing my chapters now.
Oh, good.
But, yeah, can definitely agree with this. All right, so number six is don't start at the beginning. I can definitely agree to this. Yes. One of my favorite things to do is I love kind of making like a little bullet point outline of everything. I think that's why I love writing on Scrivener so much, is you can kind of lay everything out.
Yeah.
And if you need to rearrange chapters, you can. But I rarely ever start at the beginning. Usually I'll write like a chapter to set the mood and leave it that, but never start at the beginning.
Right.
What about you?
Me? Okay, poetry-wise, you can't help but start in the beginning. You right. can't help it. But as you progress, it actually gets better, which makes more sense as a prose writer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've tried doing it in essays, and that's tough. It's mm-hmm. tough. But if you're one of those eccentrics that actually put your conclusion somewhere in the middle of your essay instead of the end, it's interesting. It gets really interesting. It gets people to kind of think. And at least artistically, I enjoy it because you are making your points right away, and you start realizing maybe people won't actually understand where I'm coming from unless I actually write an intro this way. And you add a little bit more, and suddenly, you know, people are able to laugh at your joke. Well, it's the best way to put it, really.
Yeah, even when what I tell my clients, I kind of use it like a trick question, is what's the most important paragraph in your essay? Everyone will always say the conclusion or the setup, and I always say, no, it's the second to the last paragraph.
Yes.
Because that's your pivot paragraph. And I think you can really see the skill of an essayist on the second to the last paragraph.
That's actually why Shakespeare wrote his sonnets the way it is.
Really?
Yeah, it's an essayic sonnet.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, originally, sonnets were written in an Italian lyric. So, you know, you have the Occitalian. Is that how you say it? Oh, my goodness. I don't know it. Okay.
You can always write a correction to our readers.
I think it was like Occitan or something like that. And then there's a patriarchal. And, you know, it all sounds great if you say it. Mm-hmm. But Shakespeare went ahead and actually made the first three stanzas as, you know, your certain points, and created the pivot at the end to be like the aha moment. And it's, you know,
yeah,
that's why it's written the way it is.
Yeah. Interesting.
Right.
Well, number seven is interesting. It says, go take a shower.
What? What is up with this advice?
So the only thing I can think of, I don't want to read it too much into it, because like I said, I want people to go in and read these articles. But for me, I know that I'm actually a medically diagnosed insomniac.
Ah, yes.
So, showers were actually recommended to me by my doctor. And what they say it does is, if you're really, really tense, it's not in the shower as well. In the shower, you get white noise. So it kind of gets you to remove yourself from things to a point. But the second thing is, when you get out of the shower, the contrast of the hot skin hitting the cold actually naturally makes your muscles drop.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it actually tells your brain that it's sleep time.
Huh.
The same thing kind of goes with, I don't know if you've ever noticed, even if it's really hot outside, if you even just have a fan on you, but you have to cover your body, that hit of cold air.
Yes.
It makes you sleep, right?
Right.
So that's what my doctor explained to me, is that it just naturally causes you to want to relax.
Interesting.
I don't know. Do you think differently?
I was actually thinking, like, you wrote a really bad story, and so you just want to wash yourself off. Like, oh my god, I can't believe I wrote that.
Or you've been, like, stuck in your chair for so long.
Yeah, like, stink. Yeah, you just, like, cry in the shower. Like, oh my god, no. But what do I know? Next.
The next is, ooh, this is a really good one. Balance your inner critic.
Ooh, that's a rough one.
Yeah.
You are your worst critic.
I have to agree with that.
Oh, goodness. It's literally why I toss my writing out the window after I finish it.
Yeah, Eugene is a chronic destroyer of his writing.
Yeah. I mean, like...
We're like polar opposites of each other.
Yeah, we are. I mean, one of the few written words I've actually gotten published is all the way in the UK, and it's like this little poem about a button quail. And the only reason why I got that published was because I didn't think much of it. It just followed the rules, and I thought, eh, I got enough rejection letters, let me try this one. And bam, it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only because I didn't criticize it. And it is the most awkward thing, because I want to be known as a serious sonneteer, but it seems that people like, you know, button quails.
I mean, I love button quails.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's just, I want to be epic.
Okay, we'll take a vote on Instagram if button quails are epic.
Oh, you did not.
Yes, I did.
No, no. I'm going to vote yes.
Come yeah, on. You have to. Have you seen them?
Yeah, they beep.
Okay, so for people who don't know what button quails are, from my understanding, in the UK and parts of Europe, they actually raise them as part of, like, science, like, younger kid science experiments.
Like, instead of taking care of an egg, you have a button quail.
Yeah, well, oh no, you actually, like, hatch the button quails, and then people can take them as pets, and they live for about 5 years, I think, 2 to 5 years.
Right.
I happened to get one by fluke.
Yeah, you got one.
And then after that, it was just one after the other. I think I've had, like, 6 button quails in my life, and I love them.
Yeah.
But they're called button quails because their eggs are literally the size of buttons. And when they hatch, they are the size of quarters.
Yes.
They are the cutest. So imagine these tiny little baby chicks the size of quarters.
They all usually act like your nanny. Like,
yes.
They wake you up. They scold you if you don't sleep.
Yep.
Yep. Cute little things.
Mm-hmm. And I love the males because they have the cutest little crows.
Yes.
They're adorable.
Look them up. Just yeah. Look them up.
Look them up. Or better yet, we'll put a day of button quails.
No.
Yes, we are.
Oh, no.
I freaking love button quails.
Okay.
So let's go switch up your tool.
I think we've been through this. I said,
like, physical locations, pen or paper.
Ah, this.
Typing.
Okay, this I am totally, like, understanding of. When I actually got Luke to sign the contract, I actually told him to get offline.
Hmm.
Because your eyes get strained when they look at a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And when they look at a screen, the light actually catches the attention of your iris so much that you can't help but get exhausted. So I told him, write on a book, write on paper, write somewhere, but never, you know, jot it down in front of a screen. And he thought I was, you know, kind of weird for saying that, because he's like, you have your phone everywhere. We have our laptops everywhere. Like, what else are you supposed to do? And it's like, do you listen to music? Do you not go for walks? You know? It's kind of like that. That's what writing is.
Interesting. So, for me, I got a new laptop recently, which I've written on a few times, but not quite a bit. But my favorite tool, whenever I get the chance and I know I'm in for long-haul writing, is my older laptop.
Ah, okay.
And I named her Jinx.
Yes.
She's my little black cat familiar. But I love her because she's an old school Lenovo ThinkPad, and the clankier and louder the keyboard is,
yes,
the heavier it feels to me. I love that. I feel like I can go forever on those. I used to try to do that poetic way of writing by writing in a journal.
Yes.
And then transferring it onto a typed document. But I feel like, especially in this world where we're brought up typing all the time, and the fact that I'm going for, like, quantity and number.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
So I keep my notes now in a journal.
Okay.
Okay. So, change your point of view. We're at the halfway point.
Ooh.
How are you feeling?
Halfway. I'm already exhausted.
I also wanted to bring up that they brought up an interesting article, which is linked on here, which I'd love to see in terms of your inner critic. They have one by the Harvard Business Review.
I love their stuff.
On how to make peace with your inner critic. So that's also on the link of this blog.
Okay.
So I'd love to check that out. Number 11. Exercise your creative muscles.
Okay.
What do like, we do? Like, do something different.
Smash a watermelon?
They say scribble sessions.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
I think just prompts, exercises. I mean, I can definitely agree with that.
Okay.
That's the only time you'll catch me free writing.
Yeah.
Number 12 is map out your story. I just talked about that. Absolutely, yes. 100%.
I mean, if you could set up a wall, I don't know, make it into a chalkboard or something.
Oh, a mind map.
Yes!
So you've seen me.
Oh, yeah.
Eugene has many a days seen me make...
Yeah, there was a point where you took over an entire room and we actually sprayed the wall, one wall...
In chalkboard.
In chalkboard paint. And you just went ham on it.
Well, even our door in the office is a chalkboard right now.
Right. But either way, you just can't... You can't live without that. Your brain, you know, sparks in, like, random areas... And you're trying to actually say you could actually remember everything? It's like, no. Your brain works randomly with, like, all these, like, I guess, like, all this electricity. And you have to sit down and I've got it in, like, a little thing to say, this is what happens in Chapter 3 or Chapter 10.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to create that anticipation or else the whole drama just... dies.
Right. So the other thing they suggest is write something else, and they do give a resource to a plot generator.
Oh my goodness.
I don't know. I'm not on the fence on those.
Don't do that. That's gonna actually exhaust you. Look, I get it. People love prompts, but if you're there for the long haul as a writer,
mm-hmm.
I'm just gonna say this. Prompts are there just as, I guess, fun exercises. And you get so caught up in having fun that you lose the work, the labor.
I think for me too, even if I'm working on another project, it's kind of towards the central goal.
Right.
Like, I kind of write, like, in a term of, like, a companion to the world or a companion to my overall writing.
Yes.
So nothing really goes to waste.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so agreed.
And just to kind of elaborate over my, I guess, my opinion about how not to write, I'm really sorry, I sound like I'm stuck up, but I am actually more sympathetic for those people that are having the hardest time to finish their book than for those people that want to make a perfect book. And I know there's a difference between those types of writers,
mm-hmm.
you know, so.
So this is a total segue for me into the next point, which is work on your characters. So if I'm writing something else, it's usually about another character.
Yeah.
And I'm developing that character. Like I mentioned before, I have this antagonist that I'm writing and I want to pick his brain. And I want him to be more tangible.
Right.
His origin story, I'm writing in terms of a children's book.
Right. I remember that.
Yeah. So, again, different perspectives, but working on characters.
Yeah.
And it's all for the same kind of goal.
Right.
What about you? I mean, you don't really work on characters, do you?
No. Well, I've had a few. I mean, before when we were script writing.
Okay, so tell me, is script writing different? I mean, I can say yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely different, but the method of making it is the same way. It's just a shorter distance, to be honest. It's more of a sojourn than a journey. So when you're writing scripts and you're writing characters, you try to base it on what you know. And I based it a lot on my friends. I mean, the character Penny was like based on like several arguments I've had between friends and even my own mother.
Oh my goodness.
I know. this was from Nocturnal Notes. It was a production of ours in 2007.
It's in 2007, and now I'm currently writing the novel version of it.
Yes.
And knowing that, and knowing just the history of women and the way you've interacted with women.
Right.
I've taken note of that, sorry. But I'm also trying to give her a little bit of her own twang, so I'm actually following, like, the glamour, Dita Von Teese's burlesque, vintage kind of community.
Exactly.
And I'm giving her that spin, the rockabilly, I guess, if you will.
Yeah.
Aspect.
Which is great, because more layers on a character actually builds the character. I mean, one of our favorite characters when we read a book has already had a lifetime of an experience while he's actually living the story that you're actually reading, you know?
Right. I mean, for me, I love iconography and symbolism. So, again, women and insecurities, I kind of wanted to tap into that uniqueness of why do people take the extra effort to dress up as less of a superficialness and more of a lifestyle.
Yes.
Which, I mean, to the vintage community that follows T-Spectral, I guess this character is for you in the sense that you don't dress up for the sake of beauty, per se, but you do it for a sense of ritual.
Right.
And a sense of, I guess, claiming your personification to the world.
Yes.
So that's Penny. And that's kind of what I've been working through with her.
I have to admit, I have to thank Mimi for taking
our
that role.
Our first character.
Oh, my goodness.
Or the first actress that played
Penny.
Penny, thank like, you, Mimi.
Oh, my goodness. As a guy trying to write a woman's role, it was quite one-dimensional until, you know, the actress came in and actually brought that to life. Thanks to your directing as well, Steph. Okay, you were, like, director at age 19.
Okay. No bragging.
Oh, no bragging. Not at all. Of course not.
No, I loved that. I felt like it was interesting because we were going for the typical blonde bombshell look in Penny.
Yeah.
But we ended up with a plus-size black actress. And it was so much, like, electric. It was so phenomenal.
It really was.
And after that, I swear I was sold on having a multi-ethnic cast, and I would go out of my way to try a different ethnicity in the role.
Yes.
After that, because it just was such an amazing experience to just, I guess, work based off of the person and their history and giving them that challenge. And I feel like that's what kind of brought it through is, you know, Mimi's like, look, I'm not a model. And I'm like, you can be. And we put her in the vintage stuff because it just fits a curvier body better.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what manifested the character to what it was. And that's kind of what I was going to write, or am writing.
Yes.
Hashtag am writing.
Yes.
Into Nocturnal Notes, the novel is that aspect of ritualism and reclaiming the female form.
Exactly.
Through the history of, I guess, I don't know what you call that, female presentation?
I suppose.
If anyone comes up with a better term, ladies, let me know. But yeah, absolutely.
Wonderful.
Oh, you're going to hate the next point.
How many of these do I have to not like?
Stop writing for readers.
Okay, I'm tossing the table. Like, what? What? What?
They said, stop trying to write like you're writing for the market. Write for the joy of it.
Okay, as a publisher, that is an insult. Do you want me to be poor?
Oh, man.
Okay, this is basically Belle versus the Beast in that Disney movie, Beauty and the Beast.
Uh-huh.
Okay, like, I want you to come to the table, and the writer will say, no, I don't want to meet your deadline. And you're just like, I just finished a contract with, like, Miramax or something. I need this deadline to be done. It's like, whoa! My lawyers are going to be so mad. Or, no, I think that they'd be happy. They'd love a good lawsuit.
Okay.
Stock market just went down.
As someone who's a brand strategist, I kind of hate that word because it makes me sound so pretentious, but I actually am a degree-holding
brand strategist. Yes.
I can agree to this. I mean, I agree on both ends. I think you need to play the field double. I think you need to write for yourself.
Yes.
Expect criticism if you are planning to publish. And be ready with the gloves off if you're going to.
Yeah.
So I think it depends on the character of the writer and your goals as a writer.
Absolutely. I will actually, yeah, I believe in that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there are writers out there that do want to make this a career. And they're willing to, like, lick any boot to actually make that happen.
Okay, but getting over writer's block, do you agree to just write for the joy of it? I think once you're in writer's block, I don't think you can think past that, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't think it's even about that. Maybe that's just my opinion.
Oh, but no. That makes a lot of sense. You know, like, you think you're watching the Roadrunner the entire time when you're going through the cartoon, and really, you don't realize how much the coyote is actually entertaining you. You know, you're just, it's the whole Looney Tunes thing. You think you're watching it for one thing, but it's actually another thing. You're laughing at somebody's despair, not at someone's success.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so number 16 says, try a more visual process.
Wasn't this like the mind map?
I would say that's the mind map. Oh yeah, it says create mind maps. Oh, drawings, there we go. Legos.
Ba-da-bang.
Lego structures. Ba-da-boom. Interesting. Well, I do paint my pieces.
Yes.
I do have a few of our pieces. Maybe we should share some of those.
Okay, that'd be fun.
It's been a while since I've done it.
I love doing the conspiracy theory style where you, like, take the red ribbon and say, like, oh, this is going to be connected to this, and then it's going to be connected to that. It's a whole conspiracy.
I can't do that.
Oh, I love it. I scared my mother doing that for Journey Seekers because we had to learn Victorian culture.
Yes.
When the cravat, you know, went out and the tie came in, and was this Apache Indians and, like, steam-powered engines and just all this, you know, stuff.
Yeah, we did a thing on automatons and traveling circuses.
Yeah, and just, we even brought up the bad economy. I'm like, how did we do this? No, it's just a conspiracy.
Well, like, I brought up earlier, Arthur Miller. Yes. Did The Crucible, and he compared the Cold War to
the witch hunts.
To the witch hunts. Yeah. And that's why all the characters are named the way they are. They're actual victims of the Salem witch trials.
Right.
Journey Seekers was our Victorian rendition of
steampunk.
Like, well, it was steampunk, but it was our reflection of the modern recession.
Yes. And like, all of our friends were scared.
Yeah, so we wanted to write it as kind of a lullaby for our generation.
Yeah.
And we wanted to show the tough times that were the Victorian era, because everybody thinks they're wine and roses. I mean, I'm still learning about the fascinating recession during the Regency era.
That was a depression.
Yeah, but nobody talks about it.
Like, no one was employed. Technology took over everything.
Yeah, people were going to nut houses just to stay alive.
Yeah. Everybody got tattoos.
The economy was shot. That's when
people had riots.
They were fighting child exploitation.
Yes.
There was so much going on, but I mean...
Yeah, no.
It's so interesting to have the Jane Austen paint the pretty picture. It was like the Jonesist version, but there's so much going out there with the middle class. I mean, they barely touched it with the soldiers in Waterloo and that sort of during that war. But can you imagine being the lower class dealing with going to war?
Exactly.
My goodness. And then on top of that, like, your child probably will die before you. I mean,
I know.
Not just by disease, by being worked to death.
Yes.
For the sake of staying alive. Oh, like, what does that make you feel like?
I mean, we think the horror of working for, like, you know, 20, 30, 40,
overtime, 60 hours, was it?
Yeah, nowadays. And then you're like, you look at, you know, you read about the Victorian era, and they're like, oh, yes, they work 14-hour days. I was like, what? I was like, is this why there was so much beer?
And then you would still get a second job after that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's carry on, shall we?
Yes, please.
Look for the root of it. Like, go seek out the root of your writer's block. I don't think it really works
like that. No, that doesn't work like that! No, okay, stop thinking that writer's block actually exists. It's an excuse, okay? The gods did it.
Or you've just been doing too much of it.
Exactly.
Or you just need to work on something else.
Exactly. You know, like, I get it. Our first episode, we went ahead and said reading multiple books at the same time kind of actually builds up our palate. I'm a slow reader. That actually helps me a lot, because if I actually read multiple books at the same time, I'm able to actually jump my attention from one thing to another, and I'm actually kept interested in those books. The same thing happens with writing, okay? You go right ahead and write a love letter for, you know, some wedding, and, you know, people have careers like that, but even they have to stop and actually write a little bit of horror or a little bit of comedy every now and then, just to actually get their palates, like, refined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you don't want to put too much salt on the meat.
Oh, that's one of my favorite analogies when I'm teaching.
Yeah.
Just don't oversalt your meat.
You're the one that taught me that one.
Oh, okay. Well, cheers to that. You're going to like the next one, finally.
I can like something?
On this article? Yes, they suggest at number 18 to quit the internet.
Yes! Oh my god!
In fact, they even provide links to apps that will help you block internet for certain amounts of time on your phone.
That's not... That
doesn't... I don't think it works like
that. No, it doesn't work like that.
Because you can always turn off the app.
Yeah. Yeah, what? Like, come on, you're able to put down a remote if you're actually watching TV, or, like, your gaming controller when you want to stop playing video games. Like, why do you need an app to actually stop yourself from watching an app? It's like, what? Okay, yeah, this is exactly what I told Luke, and I don't think he disagreed. I just thought, you know, he kind of looked at me kind of weird when I first said it. And it's not hard, guys. Like, it's a lot easier than you think it is.
So, I can agree with the last two. But number 19 says, let the words find you. And they say things along the lines of, take a shower, go for a walk, meditate. Basically, what I suggested, take your mind completely off of it.
Yeah.
And let them come back to you.
Have you ever, like, tried to study for an exam and you realize that, you know, you just can't study any further than you already have?
Yeah, like, for me as an adult, I feel like I way overthink things.
Yes.
Because I think when you go to college, you kind of are taught to overthink. I mean, isn't that what essay is?
Yeah.
Essay is, like, the art of overthinking. But you get in that mindset. So you overthink everything. Like, especially me on a daily basis, like if I'm dealing with a new wholesale account, I overthink the proposals. Yeah. I think I have to make this 8-page business plan, and I don't. Yeah. I think it just, in the end, summarizes down to like a 1-page email, and I'm done. And I go through that all the time.
Yeah. But, you know, if you guys are in college, I'm pretty sure you've experienced this. Take a break.
Yes.
Take a break. And then by the time you make it to the test, you'll remember what you just studied.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get it. It's so easy to just bypass the time and then do everything last minute and then say you actually will remember everything for the test while cramming, but you don't. You don't. That's just it. You just don't. Take that break and you'll be able to actually write. You'll be able to be the author you want to be.
Mm-hmm. So, this one's fun. Last tip is write like Hemingway.
I miss your Golden Frog.
Oh, yeah. Golden Frog, which is just basically, it's Phoenix steeped in gin.
Yes.
And then put to mango juice with a sugar rim topped with one of those peach rings.
Those are delicious.
It was delicious.
The reason why we're talking about alcohol, guys, for those that don't know Hemingway, is his principle was write drunk, edit sober. And I hate to say it, but there are a lot of writers like this. I don't encourage it, but if you could make that happen and you are actually, like, living off of your writing, then I guess you may just not have much of a choice. But there are other ways to actually write. And, I don't know, the Fitzgeralds were stealers. Well, I hate to say it.
He did a lot of theft on that too, which career. Is kind of sad, but they're saying, like, send it to someone else and let someone pick it apart.
That's what Hemingway did?
Yeah, apparently, and that's why the app is named after him.
Oh, it's basically like 750 words? That's basically what Hemingway is.
Oh, well, yeah. That's what they're suggesting. Either way, I totally have, on occasion, drank while writing.
And it has been successful.
And it works.
Yes, it
does. Oh, your brain hurts after it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I bet. I bet. It's like partaking in a renga.
I think a good Malbec is probably my favorite drink of choice when writing.
I can't drink it right. I can't. Like, I don't think I actually get stressed enough when I actually write to drink myself while I'm writing. I kind of actually find writing a little therapeutic. It's like a good jog or like a good swim, you know? I could go on for hours and actually get lost in like whatever words I thought I used, and then I kind of reread it and be like, is that really me? Oh my god. Like, introduce me to this guy, please.
But I usually take the sip when, again, it's one of those scenes where I'm too scared to touch it. And it definitely acts as a liquid courage. Because I'll never start it unless I just dig into it.
You see, I prefer staying up until 1 o'clock. And, you know, so like your brain does that thing where it's actually more creative during that hour. Just to actually get to that.
That thing?
That thing. It, you know, it's a thing. You go right ahead, wake up. Not wake up, but, like, stay up at 1 o'clock to, like, 3, and then suddenly, like, your brain's able to, like, think freely, creatively. Like, that's the time when your brain is actually digesting what you did the entire day and turn it into a dream. And it's, like, kind of like it's my preference. I know it takes the whole day to do it, but it's kind of my preference to actually get to that big thing.
The thing.
The thing.
Well, on that note.
Yes.
We finished all the 20 points.
Oh, at last.
Is there any last words you would like to say to people about this writing block that doesn't exist?
Yeah. If you sound or feel stupid writing nonsense, you're doing it right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's what it all comes down to. You need to create content, and you can't really edit anything if you don't have content.
I think as a writer, you learn to disappoint yourself.
Amen to that.
I think you definitely learn to get over disappointment really fast.
Yeah.
And trust me, once you start sending it out to publish, you're just helping yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. People actually self-publish themselves now and they feel great about it, but you don't really know your merit until you actually test it against a publisher's palette.
Well, even self-publishing, you still have to market your product.
See, that's the problem with self-publishing. I get it. It's great. It's been an innovation. It's made a huge market for the industry, but it's also toppled the writer. You know, you're stuck being part of the business side when you're supposed to be stuck with the creative work. And it's not very inspiring.
Hmm.
You know, you got, like, bills to pay and you suddenly have, like, contracts to write. And suddenly you are, you know, stuck with paperwork that you didn't mean to actually sign. You're not a writer after that.
Interesting. We should definitely leave that for another episode.
Yes, I could go on forever.
But I guess if you need some wise words or encouraging words, my advice to any writer with writer's block right now would be, it's not permanent. It is something we all go through. And writing is the art of time. And it is not something that is rushed. It is something that you build up to. So if you're hitting a writer's block or you're on that road and you feel it coming along, it's okay. It's just part of the process.
That's the best way to put it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So I guess we'll end on that note. Bibliophilia is available in the shop. We just made a batch, like a major batch of it yesterday. So it's nice and fresh and it's wonderful. And I hope you enjoy it. I am currently encouraging people to sign up to our newsletter, which you can do on our website at tspectral.com. We'll also have a link to that on Bibliosinensis. If you are interested in any flash sales, which will be happening quite often during the holiday seasons.
Yes.
If you're looking for things like free shipping, cheaper tea, and even free samples, sign up.
Yes.
And we will also be providing more of the fun articles and tidbits as to the inspirations of the tea and the notes behind the tea. So if you found the little talk about Damiana interesting, there's plenty of more facts about Damiana we can discuss, but those things will be provided in our newsletter. So do subscribe. Until then, bibliophiles and writers, chin chin, and we'll see you next episode or hear from you.
Cheers.